This is Geek Speak for Saturday, May 9th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. We're live this morning. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. And hello, I'm geek translator Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air studio today is Lyle Troxell, a maker, photographer, father, and senior universe. That was a senior moment for me. Senior user interface engineer at Netflix. Hello.
Hi. That's quite a title. When I wrote that, I was like, well, this could be too long. Well, as long as she doesn't mess up on the words.
Yeah, it'll be fine.
I'm sorry about that.
Also with us today, excited to have back, Dr. Don Motika, a functional medicine and integrative... I just can't speak today.
Integrative
primary care doctor in Santa Cruz and on KWSP's airwaves for Ask Dr. Don. Good morning, Dr. Don Motika.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, good, because we've got lots of stories this week, lots and lots to cover. But first, an update. So, Lyle, you know, we've talked about...
Speaking of not speaking
your
well.
love of books, and it was like Smart Dust and so on covered in a book that you mentioned last week, A Deepness in the Sky. But apparently you don't like authors. You just like to mangle their names. Is that?
I think I called him like Vince Vergen or something.
Yeah,
completely
just
wrong.
Like, come up with some words.
What
that
I actually
sound like
used for his name last week, Chandler, do you call? Okay, anyway.
That
author's name of A Deepness in the Sky, also Fire Upon the Deep and many other titles, is Werner Vinge.
Okay.
That's how you pronounce his name, Werner Vinge, author I like a lot.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's V-I-N-G-E.
It is.
For those who wanted to read up on Smart Dust in a fictional setting.
Mm. And actually, that's a very small part of the novel. The novel's actually about changing the human brain to kind of modify the brain to be specialized computers, with the idea that when you see sometimes an autism, you'll see highly fixated outputs of a person.
Mm-hmm.
One of Werner Vinge's ideas in Deepness in the Sky is that a whole race of people can be modified that way, so you have an expert in every single field,
right,
and they become your supercomputers to some degree. It's kind of cool.
Oh, that is kind of cool.
Yeah, I think I just ruined a plot point, though. But read it. It's a great book.
Spoiler alert. Okay, while we're doing science fiction, though, I have
to chime
in here.
Okay.
I am doing, I'm currently rereading for the second time because it's so convoluted that I had to read it twice to really fully enjoy it. Peter Hamilton's The Great North Road, which is all about police, smart dust, incredible sorts of forensics based on technologies that are just about there.
Yeah.
And also some, you know, very interesting intrigue and the ultimate locked room murder mystery. So all thrown in and shake well and stir.
The Great North Road by
the Great
Hamilton.
North Road. Yes, Peter Hamilton.
So. And you're reading a second time. Do you do that often?
No.
Yeah.
No, mostly I don't need to, but this one had so much science in it and multiple plot lines, and it's like Cloud Atlas, another book I highly recommend.
Oh, with other layers.
So many layers that you really have to decide what layer you're reading it at and read it that way. And then, so the first time I read for plot, now I'm reading for the juxtapositions of the different subplots as you bounce around through them.
Hmm,
so,
cool.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of internal clanging associations that he makes that if you're reading for the storyline, you don't get them.
Right on. I just picked up, just was sent Neal Stephenson's newest book, so I'm looking forward to starting that actually today. Speaking of novels.
Do you want to talk about that for a
Well,
moment?
No, I haven't started it yet, so we'll definitely,
all right.
I think
we'll cover
we'll
that
do
later
it after.
Yeah. So also in the category of things that we're following up on, Don, last week you mentioned a little bit about EMF and how that relates to sperm. And could you just refresh our memory on what EMF is?
Well, those is electromagnetic fields, and of course EMF, electromagnetic frequencies, so they're used kind of interchangeably. But effectively what we're talking about is all that Wi-Fi, all those cell phones, radar.
Oh, right.
There's beams of energy moving through.
Why radio works, actually.
Yes. Yeah. Well, these are radio's waves are very, very, very long. It's, mm-hmm. They're at a different scale from our cells. But cell phone radiation is a much smaller, shorter mm-hmm. wavelength. And as a result, it can make our bodies vibrate. And that was what we thought was the issue, was just heating. And this mm-hmm. goes back to the days of radar when they were first playing around with this technology. And mm-hmm. it's like, oh, you know, I can heat up my lunch if I just leave
you know,
it on the radar.
One of the first stories to find this out is that security guards, you know, people that were forced to support, you know, protect the radio stations, they would have cold nights and they would just stand in front of these dishes and be warm. And of course, we discovered the technology and started using it more effectively, and we call them microwave ovens.
Right.
And
exactly.
It's basically that's the frequency at which you can get water molecules to rotate very quickly. The polarity of a water molecule is the size of that and the frequency of microwaves. Relate to each other such that you get an oscillation that's kind of a stable oscillation by the waveform. And so that's why microwave ovens work. And they actually don't work very well on frozen material because frozen water doesn't move. The molecules don't move as much. So
it has to
agitate.
It
takes a while. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad we're talking about this again because it did come up. Someone heard the show last week and said, wait a minute, I thought that they had disproven that there was any problem. With cell phones being close to my
Well, that would be
pocket.
An industry-sponsored study that probably used a very low dose of radiation.
After the show, you and I kind of debated a bit about that,
yeah,
and it felt like,
guys,
we should have some studies about
guys
this.
Guys don't want to think that carrying their cell phone in their front pocket is an issue, mm-hmm. right? You just don't want to.
So what's the science say?
You don't want to think that. Well, okay, let's start with... this study is, let's see, Reproductive Technology, January 2010, and they were looking, they were very scientific about it. They gave people a exposure meter, mm-hmm. and they looked at the at exposure to the fields and poor sperm quality.
Mm.
And
so I'm assuming they were testing men, mostly for the study.
Men. And these were sperm donors.
Oh, okay. So they had a regular visit with these people.
So basically they had a regular visit, and the people, effectively, the people who had the highest doses were the ones who had the poorest sperm quality.
Oh, so they actually gave these people a meter that probably went in their pocket or near their middle region mm-hmm. that would detect the frequencies that they were concerned about.
Exactly. An exposure meter, kind of like the dosimeter that a radiology technician wears.
Right.
And if your film badge turns brown, you're on...
And we don't know what the danger level is for some of these things. We just assume that we don't have, we don't necessarily know. So what they did is they did a study where they measured the amount of energy in these frequency ranges, gave it to all these sperm donors, checked their sperm count, and there was a, what do they call it when there's a match in the pattern.
Right. And so really, realistically, what we're talking about is induction, okay? So you've got an electromagnetic field. So mm-hmm. if you can measure a magnetic field. We have those. That's what they were carrying around.
Yep.
And essentially what they found was a very high confidence interval. P value was 0.03 for the trend test.
Okay.
Increasing duration of the field exposure above 1.6 milli-G's, and I don't know what
G's. Okay,
I don't know what a milli-G is, but it basically doubled the risk of abnormal sperm motility. This is human studies. There's tons of rat studies, which I'll allude to in a moment.
But this is a cool human study. How many people were in the study? Was it a relatively large sample set? Mm. Well, I guess they had a 0.3 in there.
Yeah, I'm looking
at test results.
Yeah, they had
good.
A 0.3. So they I don't know.
Does
this
that
is
mean
I'm
they
looking
had
at
a 0.3.
Okay. So, the way we value statistics, we have two levels, two cutoff levels. One is a 0.05 confidence p value. That means that there's a 1 in 20 chance that this happened by chance, you know.
Okay.
If I do the same study 100 times, uh-huh. then I would get 5 studies that showed that this drug was active, and I'd get 95 studies that would show it was inactive.
I see. Okay.
So that would mean...
It's a way of determining...
Yeah, exactly. So if the chances...
Like a wisdom of the crowd factor.
Well, effectively. But essentially, you can always have things turn out looking like there's a positive effect, but it's just by chance. You flip the coin 20, mm-hmm. 10 times and it comes up 9 in a row. That doesn't necessarily mean the coin is loaded.
Right.
So, but the next time you flip it, you won't get that 90%. And then if you do that 20 times...
So that p-value is the way we kind of talk about it mathematically. So this study was a
p 0.03. So it was better than... So what's that 1 in 30?
Yeah.
Okay. Chance of it being...
So most likely, statistically, it sounds pretty much like it's valid.
And you always want to see things like this replicate, but you have to understand that getting funding to do a study when there is so much industry...
It's harder and harder. Nobody wants
this to be true. Let's be clear. I don't want to be true.
Yeah.
I've got a router, Wi-Fi thing sitting on my desk 3 feet away from my chest.
Sure.
Breast cancer. I don't want it to be true either.
Yeah.
Let me give you some more. Let me give you some more info.
Well, I wanted to talk about just in general. This data clearly shows a sperm count change, and you and I chatted quickly about why sperm count's a really interesting way to measure effects. There's some assumption that this stuff doesn't affect the body at all, and yet now this study clearly says there's a side effect. Why would sperms be such a good way to check this?
Well, the reason we like sperm is that they're easy to get.
Men you can are measure them.
Indiscriminate in their
Thanks,
willingness
fellas.
To give us sperm, and so it's a replenishable resource.
Uh-huh.
So you can study it. It's also, in contrast to, say, a red blood cell, which is a living cell, but a red blood cell doesn't have a nucleus. It doesn't divide. It isn't biologically active in the same way that a sperm is. A sperm is using so much energy to whip that little tail around
mm-hmm.
that if you're trying to study mitochondria, which is where we think the injury is occurring, you're going to get an immediate effect, like when I put my Prius in the brake mode and I drive on the freeway, my mileage cuts in half.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I could see that. I could see the drag on the power of my engine. And so you can visually look at the sperm and see how fast the tail is whipping around, and you can watch the thing slow down.
Yeah.
Okay. And so plentiful material where you can see immediate results.
Macroscopic.
Yep.
You don't require it. It's visual.
Additionally, what's interesting about it is that when the body's in stress, there's some functions that do not shut down, right? A stressed body, your brain's doing fine in some sense. I mean, it's overstimulated.
Heart's still beating.
Heart still beats, right? Blood production. But you actually shut down digestive system if you're under enough stress. And like one of the reasons why you have to have a movement before you leave the hospital, because that means that system's back online.
Mm-hmm.
And reproductive, of course, is one of those too. When you're in stress, your body's not going to focus on reproductive. So therefore, anything that can cause the system to have trouble, you'll see in those kind of outputs. And that's why it's such a good one as a metric. Now, you alluded from concerns of cancer, and I want to go back to that for just a second. This is about sperm count, which wouldn't necessarily be about mutation.
That's right.
And so they could be different things.
They're totally different things.
But clearly we don't have the answers.
We don't have a mechanism for the cancer connection.
Right.
We have the fact that people who work in electric power plants have higher cancer rates, particularly blood cancers. We think that there's probably an effect there that is the EMF fields being toxic, but mechanism... It's only postulated.
Right.
There's not really good support for any particular mechanism. Here's one where they just took sperm in a dish,
uh-huh.
In a test tube, and they basically put it in two boxes. One box had a cell phone that was on
mm-hmm.
on top
transmitting.
Of it,
mm-hmm.
and the other one didn't. And they looked at immediate changes in motility and function.
And
The sperm slowed down.
Yeah, interesting.
And so you see decreased motility. And increase in reactive oxygen species, which are free radicals. So there's stuff going on that is observable. It's
concerning. Okay, what are you doing about it? You're a cell phone user, a mobile device user, and a doctor, and you see these studies. What do you do?
Okay, first thing is that I use my speaker phone a lot.
Uh-huh.
So I don't put my phone up to my ear because the inverse square law is your friend.
This is how far...
Actually, there's a show, and I'll try to find that for you, where we talked about precautions to take. But the nutshell it's up on the website. AskDrDon.com.
We will link to it from this show when we find it from GeekSpeak's website.
We'll send it to you
and
put the link.
Yeah.
But essentially, you use your speakerphone. You don't carry the phone in your pocket. And
handbags, everybody.
Handbags. Well, or if you're going to carry it in a pocket, maybe your back pocket. Because at least it's 12 inches to your testicles.
Right, yeah.
And I don't, if you can get it 2 feet from your body, that's much better. If you can get it 3 feet from your body,
yeah.
That's, by then you've cut, it's basically a ninth of the amount of radiation. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's right up to your ear, it's 100%
sure,
of the amount
sure.
of radiation.
That's what you mean by the inverse square law. The more distance, the less of an effect.
Yeah, basically, if you're one foot away, then it's one squared.
So are you, when you did this research this last week about this, did you see other cases where we don't see effects or anything else besides sperm count? Or is it just such a great metric
to see it?
Oh, no, there's lots of, most of the other studies, however, are done on animals.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to lead with the human studies.
But
there's just tons of rat and mice studies.
Where there is effect?
Where there's effect. And what you're seeing, it's kind of interesting. You don't see more mutations in the sperm.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the testicles and section them and look, the tubules shrink. So there's some kind of structural effect on the seminiferous tubules. You get just as many sperm, but more of them die off before they leave the body. So mm-hmm. you have an increased rate of apoptosis.
So the point here being that something definitely is happening physically to the organization. I mean, you could assume
that... I want to mention that apoptosis is controlled by the mitochondria.
So
if you make the mitochondria unhappy in a cell,
then there's an effect on the whole sperm.
Then the cell basically gets the signal to die.
The
mitochondria have a kamikaze switch that they can pull.
Do we have an idea of what the mechanism here is? I mean, I understand electromagnetism.
What's happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's happening?
Well, there's hypotheses that are supported by the data but not definitively proven. The primary one is a phenomenon called electroporation. And I talked about this briefly last week, but essentially all of our cells are lipid bilayers, and the mitochondria have several layers of lipid bilayer, and they pump ions. It's basically an ion pump, and you create
how the energy gets created in
you
cell.
You create a gradient, mm-hmm. essentially, and I've seen these little toys where you have two liquids of different viscosity, and one's in an upper chamber and one's in the lower chamber, and when you flip it over, the heavier liquid will drop through the lighter weight liquid, and I've even seen where they put a little water wheel in there, and you just flip the wheel.
Those are fun,
but that's a mitochondria. Essentially, that gradient is driving a wheel. That wheel is actually a chemical structure.
Right.
And this is a cytochrome series of handoffs that lower the energy state of the electrons, and at each lowering, it drives the formation of ATP.
Right.
So a good functioning...
The energy of the cell, if you will.
Right. Mm-hmm. A good functioning mitochondria gets great gas mileage from two molecules of carbon. It pulls out 28 molecules of ATP. Now, glycolysis, which is a bacteria, that you can only get like 8 molecules. But you can mess up that gradient and you reduce the gas mileage of the mitochondria.
Yeah. And so you're saying that because this is a chemical reaction that has to do with ion movement, and it could make sense that that place is sensitive to electromagnetic interference.
You're punching little holes. You're temporarily... it's a metaphor.
Yeah.
But you're punching little holes in the lipid bilayer by twisting the proteins, disrupting the structure. So the proteins are polarized, so they'll move in response to a field change. And that rips the lipid bilayer, creates a ripple. And it's literally a ripple. If it's temporary, it opens up a little hole.
Right.
That hole allows leakage.
And that system doesn't work as well.
And that system loses mileage.
So that's the current idea of why this is occurring.
For the mitochondria, and then the cancer connection is... the free radical thing is interesting. It could be... Because free radicals are carcinogenic.
Sure, sure.
And
we're talking about very minute levels because you're still dealing with the cell reproduction. I mean, it's still a very small level.
Sure. Just a little bit of sun every day.
Yeah.
Cool.
Stuff.
Thank you so much for getting us hooked on that.
Well,
I'm definitely
going to have
a
doctor with us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Before we go, I've got one.
One last thing. We heard from our Canadian correspondent and also another listener that the G in Millie G means Gauss.
Oh, of Gauss, of course.
It's Millie Gauss.
Okay. No, I got to say this. CoQ10 and L-carnitine actually protect you. So I found a study where they were giving EMF to mice, looking at the sperm effect.
Uh-huh.
And if you give L-carnitine and CoQ10, big doses, 200 milligrams per kilogram, before they exposed them, that you didn't get the damage to the sperm.
Cool. So it's time to start taking pills for your cell phone.
That's what that's for. I was so sure. What is that stuff for? But that would be one use for it. CoQ10.
Good for your heart, too.
Okay.
All right. Protect your sperm.
It's actually... you're listening to Geek Speak here on KOSP, although we do have the host of Ask Dr. Dawn with us. And when we come back, we'll be talking about gamification and how that plays out, how you can use gamification. We'll talk about what it is and how it can apply to your health and other areas of your life. When we come back, this is Geek Speak on KOSP. Another fine show on KUSP is the Seventh Avenue Project. More than a century before the first electronic computer, eccentric British genius Charles Babbage invented his own number cruncher, a mammoth mechanical brain powered by steam. It took another eccentric genius, Ada Lovelace, to recognize its true potential. Their odd couple partnership is a great intellectual adventure story, and it's the subject of a sumptuous new graphic novel by animator Sydney Padua. She talks to KUSP's Robert Polly about the thrilling adventures of Lovelace and Babbage, the mostly true story of the first computer. You'll hear that on the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow at noon on KUSP, or anytime you like from the talk section of KUSP.org. Right now, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air studio today is Lyle Troxell and Dr. Don Motika. And Lyle, I said the word gamification before our
break.
And
I kind of winced, actually, when you did it, but go on.
Why? Why, though?
Because this it becomes a marketing term. This started because I read this wonderful article about a video game letting people learn how to play guitar. You guys know Guitar Hero?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you played it, Bonnie?
I never have, but okay. I have played Dance Dance Revolution.
Similar in some sense. Well, yeah. So they have a very similar idea. You play a song is being played, and then you're being cued to engage with the song. With Guitar Hero, you have a plastic guitar with buttons on it. You're supposed to push them at a certain rate. Uh-huh. And when this occurs, it looks like you're kind of playing music.
Right.
And people kind of feel that way.
Uh-huh.
Well, in reality, there is a game that does teach you how to play guitar called Rocksmith. Okay. And theoretically, it does a pretty good job. You actually plug a real electric guitar into your system, and you actually play electric guitar, and it has detections on what note you're playing, and it slowly builds up your ability to play guitar.
Okay.
And you can learn how to play guitar doing this.
So it's like a game, but you're learning an actual skill.
Right.
Okay.
And the general concept of that is generally called gamification.
Right.
But unfortunately, gamification also is used in marketing terminology because it's a great idea to use game concepts to make people do things.
So like when I want to watch a Hulu program without multiple interruptions, then I have to play the stupid trivia game.
A little different than that, but yeah, that's irritating too.
Yeah.
I know you got them there. Ian Bost has referred to the term as a marketing fad and offers the alternative explorationware, meaning that instead of talking about it being gamification, it's just something that exploits your emotional state.
But isn't gamification in its original sense meant like how to engage with life through a game and just get your boring stuff done?
Yes.
My nerd friends on Facebook will say, achievement unlocked, the kitchen is now clean.
Yeah. Well, so sometimes these things are given as a reward system.
Uh-huh.
You get a bell or you get a chime, you get something like that, which offers that award pattern is definitely used in games.
Yeah.
But that is not a game by any means. Getting a reward is not a game.
Right.
I mean, schoolwork, you get A's or B's, right?
Yeah.
And it feels better to get an A. You sometimes get F's too, by the way. Happens too. But that's not a game. That's just a mechanism that's used in games. And lots of times people gamify a system by giving rewards and think now it's a game.
Uh-huh.
So an example of this that we're seeing, we talked about smartwatches last week that would kind of give you feedback and over time might log what you're doing and give you feedback. And then you can start playing your should I walk up the stairs or not as a game, right? In the sense that there's a goal for you. A game, though, has a pattern of win and loss. It's not play. There's actually a conclusion to a game, if you will.
Mm-hmm. In your lexicon, does a game have to involve competition?
No, I don't think a game has to do. Well, let's see. No, I don't think so.
Competition against your own best?
Because it could be against your prior performance.
Possibly prior performance, right. Yeah. I think that most games have a success, a concept that does feel that way. I did a lot of role-playing games, mm-hmm. and in some ways, role-playing games aren't even games. They're more of play, mm-hmm. because even though you want to keep your character alive, the death of a character in a amazing way might be the best gaming experience you had. So I'm definitely loose on the terminology.
Well, and we don't want to get stuck on this discussion being about the definition of game, because then we get into the whole sort of alternate games that are pissing off the Gamergate guys.
So the thing, the things I want to tell you more about are about some other games that actually are game-style learning experiences, like Duolingo. Have either of you used Duolingo?
No, but I sure have heard about it.
You have heard about it.
Yeah.
So Duolingo is a system in which you play, and as you play, you learn a language. And again, you can become fluent in the language with this game. It will take you all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's interesting about it is it's actually the language that it's teaching you is helped by people learning the game. So as you get experts in a language using the system, they might make a phrasing about how to sit on a couch in a certain language. Mm-hmm. And if that shows up a lot, why people that know that language, that phrasing will be used in the system to teach you how to talk about sitting on a couch in a certain language. So the system
so
grows
where the
as you go.
People participating help improve everyone's results.
Yes. Yeah. The more people participate, the more, better.
Okay. So I'm interested in how that applies to healthcare and maintaining your health.
Mm.
Because I have heard about this idea of making it a game being used to help people get better. There's a famous person in, you know, let's make life a game, Jane McGonigal. And she got a concussion one time. And to help her get over her concussion, get support from her community in her recovery, she formed a game called Super Better. And it's like a whole system. You can go to superbetter.com and interact with it and sort of, you know, set up your super friends, you know, to help you get better, recover from something, or, you know, get through any kind of a health trial. And is that something that you've heard of, Dr. Don?
Oh, yeah. And let's see, I went to Health 2.0 in, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very intriguing because it was just so many people who were trying to use this gamification concept and link it to their devices or link it to, you know, you go to this website, become part of this community, and then you have all of these various competitions and things that people were doing and offering a lot of support and kind of closing the loop. The research subsequently, none of these have really taken off across the board, and I think what's emerging is that there are responders and non-responders mm-hmm. to this as an approach.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are, you know, heavily hooked into the social media, who have porous boundaries and are very, you know, sort of betas, they're cooperative people who are very much paying attention to what other people...
People that play Farmville, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I guess that would be one group.
Uh-huh.
And they do very well with, like, wearing a Fitbit and then being hooked on, going onto a website and saying, yeah, I walked 10,000 steps today. I met my goal. And then, you know, Cindy G says, go you. And then you get a little squirt of dopamine because you're hooked into this, collaborative group mentality as part of your self-identity, in other words, your boundaries.
And that's almost not a game, but more of a social impact thing.
Well, I'm having a hard time differentiating it.
Ah, interesting.
Because... It ultimately, what is a game, particularly if you go play softball with the company team mm-hmm. or something like that, that's largely a social mm-hmm. activity. I mean, it's really not about, it's more about the camaraderie than it is about hitting the home run.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that social interaction works well for encouraging health behaviors. We're very influenced by what the people around us do. In fact, like if three of your weight is... The best predictor of your weight is the weight of your friends, statistically speaking.
Social has a strong impact on health.
It does. Yeah. And certainly you could see where in diet and diabetics.
So Jane McGonigal is actually a part of the nonprofit Games for Change,
mm-hmm.
Whose mission statement is catalyzing social impact through digital games.
Right.
Definitely a connection with her social impact or social structures and game systems. It makes sense in some regards. Even when you do have a badge from a system, some of the learning experiences, when you finish a course, you get a badge and you get to put that on your email or on your website or whatever. Part of that is the sharing of that value to somebody else, right? When you have high marks in classes, part of that is your parents going, yay! You know, I mean, there's an aspect of that social feedback.
Yeah, and I think it's really neurological and mm-hmm. how you're wired. But at full disclosure, I went to UCLA, studied psychobiology. It was a behaviorist's heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I know all about Skinner boxes and rat mazes and things like that.
Yeah.
And you know, biologically, there's this thing called dopamine, and that's your reward center. And you make associations. So something that triggers dopamine, pleasure, various types of pleasures trigger dopamine. Chocolate bar triggers dopamine. If you...
Finishing a level on a game.
If you...
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so if you can link a behavior to something that starts, that gives you dopamine, and then eventually you can take away... the secondary trigger, and this is classical conditioning. The bell, the dog salivates.
Yeah.
You train your brain to release dopamine when it sees an image right. of something that has previously been paired with another stimulus that created dopamine. So eventually the associational pathway works. You could conceivably set this up with whatever the person was into. I mean, I'm sure you could get really evil here. You could show the pictures, very short pictures. You could watch what happens to the pupillary dilation. You'd figure out, okay, I'm going to say naked blonde women really works to raise dopamine level in this particular individual. I'm going to send him a subliminal naked blonde woman every time he does 10,000 steps. Before long, just the bell, just the you did it, congratulations, will give the same level of dopamine. We can take out the subliminal naked blonde woman uh-huh. that's flashing on his screen.
Sounds like it's interesting because when you talk about this, it reminds me a lot about marketing, right? That this is what we're doing in marketing
you're
as well.
Trying to encourage purchasing behavior, yeah.
I think the fact that the marketing people are using this and are all over it like fleas on a dog, I think that's a very good reason because it is exactly what they do.
Yeah.
And you have to be... My, you know, kind of thing is you got to be careful what games you play and what reward patterns you set up
That's
for
true.
Yourself.
That's true, absolutely.
Because rewarding yourself with food, for example, may not be such a great idea.
I mentioned Farmville, and the reward system there is the game itself, and the side effect is pestering your friends, right? So you're rewarded to pester your friends, which is my feedback because I've never played it. So I want to talk about one other game, which I think is actually kind of awesome in the same vein. Yeah?
Yeah.
And that is Zombies Run. Have you heard about this one?
No.
No, what is it?
This is great. Okay, so you play this game on your phone when you run. It keeps track of how far you're running. And as you're going through different milestones, it gives reports about a zombie apocalypse takeover and how you have to get away from them. So it inspires you with fear to get away. But you also, if you run a certain distance, you save a certain amount of people from the top of a building. So basically, it's a whole system about the zombie chasing you, and it's a running game. Which is kind of cool.
It is cool.
So the ones I'm recommending, because if you care about games a lot but you want to improve yourself, Duolingo, fantastic language learning. Rocksmith, if you want to learn how to play guitar. I mean, this all takes a lot of time, right? You got to really invest yourself in this.
Yeah.
And of course, running, of course, I think you should be probably doing every day, assuming you have good bone structure.
Good knees.
And if you're curious about gamification in general as a course, Kevin Werbach has from University of Pennsylvania has done a whole course on Coursera, which means you can just take the course for free. And what could be more fun than a course about fun is what he says. I'm not sure it's really about that, but anyway, there you go.
Also ruined something.
I want the zombie program on an Oculus Rift.
Yes.
That also has you know radar, so it's going to give me my path and give
so
me a fake environment, so I don't run into something. And at the same time, going to give me zombies that I can see and run away from. And
you could use the Oculus Rift on a treadmill.
There
right?
you go.
So yeah,
there you go.
That'd be relatively safe.
You'd have to hook it up to... Hey, you know, there's something there. We should talk to some advertising people.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, really.
Patent that puppy.
Oh, for Pete's sake. So, all right. So gamification, and this will come up again. I got a whole big fat book on gamification. It's sort of a reader articles from all kinds of people. So as I actually crack that book and read more about it, then I imagine this topic will come up again on Geek Speak here. You know what I want to talk about now is pronunciation, because we took another crack at it this morning with poor Werner. We've gotten more feedback this time from Aaron Ferrucci that the way to actually say Werner Vinge's name is it's more like Vinge.
Vinge, like stingy.
Or stingy. Oh, stingy.
Vinge.
Vinge.
Okay.
All right.
Not Vinge.
We
Vinge.
Do keep trying. Yeah. Not Vinge.
You know, I know how it's spelled. I read it all the time. But,
but whoever says it out loud. All right. So another thing that people debate about how to pronounce are those annoying little coffee pods.
Oh, gosh. I hate these things.
And I've heard
so
Keurig,
coffee makers that
Keurig.
Yeah. Yeah.
And apparently the way it's really pronounced, if you're a Dutch person, it's from a Dutch word. The person who invented it is Dutch. Keurig, it's Keurig.
Keurig.
Keurig. Keurig. It means neat. So there's a tidiness factor, right, with just those little coffee pots. So if you want to pronounce it like a real Dutch person, Keurig. And if you want your fellow Americans and Canadians, as our Canadian correspondent points out, if you want them to understand what the heck you're talking about, you mispronounced it Keurig like everyone else does.
All right. Keurig.
Keurig.
And do you know the name of the company is actually Keurig Green Mountain? So I guess it's Neat Green Mountain.
Oh, huh.
Yeah, that's the actual name of the company.
You know, mountains aren't necessarily neat, nor is green stuff. It's delightfully messy and full of life.
Well, the thing about these... The thing about these pods, now I'm sure everyone's familiar with these, this little tiny bit of coffee in like a little metal dish with a plastic top, and you stick it in a machine and you pull the lever and it collapses down and runs hot water through the coffee, as all coffee machines do.
I know it as a way to slow down my ability to start a workshop again because everyone's in line to make their one cup of coffee
at a
time. Little
pod things.
Annoying.
Very wasteful too, because all these little pods are side effects that have to be dealt with. Right. And whether they're made of plastic, whatever.
Yeah. Keurig, I always thought it was a triumph when you could see those pods not only produced by Keurig, but all kinds of people making the pods that you could fit in your machine.
Yeah, kind of a problem actually for the Keurig company, because of course they make the machine, and part of making the machine is, oh, once we've done this, people just buy coffee from us, and that's a lucrative market to be in. So we make a pod, we trademark and copyright the pod design, patent the pod design, and therefore if you make a pod that matches our spec, we can sue you. But that doesn't stop people from making these pods.
Right.
And
still out there.
Last year, they stepped up their game, and Keurig, decided that it would be really cool if they could do what printer companies do with their ink cartridges. Wouldn't it be neat if they could sense their cartridge so that if the cartridge is made by them, the machine works. If the cartridge is made by somebody else, the machine don't make and send.
Wait
make
a
works.
Minute. That sounds like that annoying thing, DRM.
Yes, it's digital rights management. It's the kind of concept of being able to control things. We see this in printers. We see this in software all the time. Mm. When you have software you're supposed to be able to run, you have the ability to do that. The keys work. Everything works. When you've copied it kind of without the right to do so, you have restrictions. That whole area is called digital rights management, because who has the right? They're embedding this in their machine with the idea being that though you own the coffee machine, we own the software on the machine, and therefore the software is not yours. It's being leased by you under agreement, and you can only use that software if it's done the way that we've produced it. Now, because the Millennium Digital Copyright Act, circumventing that is actually illegal. Therefore, if you were to put a coffee pod in one of these machines and do something to bypass it, technically you're bypassing a software pattern which is protected by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. One of the reasons why that act is so horrible.
So let me see if I've got this right. Keurig wanted to do DRM in their pods so that only their proprietary pods could be used in the machine and anything else would kind of shut the machine down.
Yeah.
There was an attempt to circumvent that, a workaround. Sort of EFF type fight.
Actually, it was really easy to circumvent, and I'll tell you a little bit how. But.
Okay, so we'll hear more about that in a second. And then it was declared that that was not okay either. That workaround was not okay.
I wouldn't say that it was declared that. I'm just mentioning that it could theoretically be, against it. Yeah.
Okay,
but
so
what
it
actually
could be
happened,
challenged. And
what
it
actually
has not
happened
been.
Is, yeah, so Rogers Family Company, which is a coffee making company, hated the idea of this because, of course, they don't. People wouldn't buy coffee from them anymore.
Right.
And so they gave away a freedom clip, which is basically a little thing that could clip over the sensor that would read the barcode and just say, hey, everything's good. Go ahead. Okay. And that's what way it bypassed. In fact, you could just take a piece of scotch tape and stick it on the sensor, and then you could put any pod in there you wanted. In fact, you could open up a pod, put more coffee into it, empty out the old coffee, put a new coffee in, close it up, and put it back in. You can do that too.
Ah.
So it's really easy to bypass it. But the whole point of it is that it's a business model they want to provide where the machine would be really cheap potentially, and the pods would be really expensive. You get the machine in your house, and it feels like, oh, I got to use those coffee pods.
Well, it really is the printer model.
Oh, it's exactly the printer model.
Ew.
It's disgusting. And luckily, on Wednesday night, the CEO of Keurig said, we were wrong. This was wrong.
Really?
Yes, which is the great news. It's over.
Are they shutting down the whole company?
No, they're just stopping that pattern of having those chips in there. In fact, they even sell a reusable pot if you want to use your own coffee.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Luckily, one company saw the light. And the basic reason why they saw the light is because they got a lot of flack for this.
So that worked.
That worked. Internet can speak.
And interestingly, they paid attention to the flack just about the DRM thing, not about how wasteful and heinous and mysteriously hard to use those machines are. All
Keurig.
Right, fair enough. This is Ben's Bailiwick, Machine Learning.
It is.
But he's not here and stuff is happening.
That's
so
right.
We're going to talk about it anyway.
He actually might have covered this story at some level.
Well, I think he has started the beginning of it, just being able to translate not just an object or a face, but a whole scene.
Yeah. So in image image detection and translation, one of the golden would be, wouldn't it be great to be able to do this, would be to be able to take a photograph and give it to a system, and the system say what that photograph depicts, the entire scene of that photograph. Mm-hmm. An example would be to go through all my thousands of images and tell me all the places that are at the beach, mm-hmm. right? Just from the image itself, not from like geolocation. And wouldn't it be cool if we could have a system do that? It's one of those, if you had that ability, a robotic thing could very easily navigate the world. It would know it was at an intersection. So that is a high goal for machine learning.
Yeah. And an important one if we're going to have our self-driving cars.
Yes. So a project at MIT, which was written about with a really wonderful article describing this by Larry Herodsty of the MIT News Office.
Wait, how do you say his name?
I don't know. Let's go on. I know that's coming in the subject line of the title of the show this week. Can't pronounce diddly.
Yeah.
So this project took 7 million images labeled by scene type. So 7 million images is a lot of images. So this is a beach. This is a bedroom. This is a coffee shop. This is a street. This is a sewer. You know, whatever the scene was.
Okay.
It's a high-level description of the entire image. And the image could be anything as long as it's in that kind of descriptive scene, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And 7 million different images. And then they used a neural net type pattern, which I don't want to go into detail. If you're really interested in this topic and want to learn more, Ben Jaffe, our regular geek here, has a wonderful podcast called Linear Digressions with Katie Malone, and they talk about machine learning and neural nets and all that kind of space. I highly recommend it. We'll link to it from geekspeak.org. But in a nutshell, you give a system a very a networked idea of detection, mm-hmm. and then you put it in a whole bunch of data. And at the backside of that, all that data, you kind of say, yes, you were successful. And then new images come in, and that map of network will result in an answer that hopefully matches what your goal is. So you kind of condition a system to learn over itself. And the point is that the system actually learns based off the data you put into it and the positive signals you give it. It does its thing, kind of like the way our human brains work, such that when you're a child and you try to stand up and you fall and you try to stand up, you fall. Every time you succeed, the system hardens its success. And after over a while, your system can just stand up. You can stand up from the floor, unless, of course, you're drunk. So that's how neural net work. So they put in these 7 million images, and in training the system, they got a pretty good success rate. Now, first off, if I give a picture to you of a scene, we actually will agree upon the terminology about 80% of the time.
Okay.
I might give you a scene of the beach,
right.
And you might say barbecue.
Yeah.
Because it looks to you like it's barbecuing at the beach. And for you, a beach is not so important because you live in the beach, but barbecue is unique. And therefore, you might label it a barbecue scene versus a beach scene. So 80% success rate in scene detection is what us humans do. And their system at MIT, they were able to get a 50% success rate, which is amazing. Any picture you want, you put it in and it tells you what the output is at about a 50% rate, which is awesome. So the thing that was curious to them is, how is this neural net working? Like, we can't peer into Bonnie's brain by slicing it open to find out how she detects barbecue versus beaches.
Yeah.
But with a neural net, you can actually look into it. And so they started digesting and inspecting the system to find out, how did the neural net come up with the idea that this is a beach scene versus a bedroom? How is it doing this?
Right, yeah.
And the thing that's neat about this is, it's not like there's a language inside this system. There's not a language inside our brain, right? We have language on the outside of some of our flow of images.
It describes that whatever is really happening
right.
there, but it's not what's really happening in
there. Right. So the opportunity to look at a neural net that has relatively close to what humans can do and how it works is really intriguing. So what they did is even though there's 7 million entries of photos, what they did is they took a look at images that had nodal regions in this network that were really hot. So they put a whole bunch of images and they calculated out about 60 different locations of sites, different nodal spots that were really hot for certain sets of images.
What is that? I don't get
it. Okay, they took a whole bunch of images in and they said, okay, in this network of little tiny processings, we can count how many times one area gets hot, one area works, functions, has a success in.
Okay, so high success rate for identifying particular things?
Potentially, right. They didn't know exactly.
Okay.
So they looked and they saw, okay, here's a whole bunch of different sites, 60 different sites that have, many different sites that have a lot of success, okay?
Okay.
And therefore, here are the most successful images for that area. So this area is interesting. Here is the top 60 images that makes that area light up and not other areas light up.
So when those are all successful, then that becomes a good foundation for learning what other objects are?
Well, so we'll get into that. Exactly. So they took and they went and used they took these nodes and they had 60 images for each node, and they wanted to find out what is in that picture that that node is actually detecting. Uh-huh. What is going on there? Why does all these pictures say this is a beach scene? Uh-huh. And this one node is hot. What's going on? So they wanted to find people that would also do something that would calculate these. So they turned to Amazon's Mechanical Turk. Now, do you know what Amazon's Mechanical Turk is, Bonnie?
I think what Amazon's Mechanical Turk is, it's like that SETI project, right? Like it's a bunch of people working individually to process large amounts of data that require a human element.
That's right.
Mechanical Turk. But in working together in mass, they sort of become like a computer.
Yes. So the Mechanical Turk from Amazon service is a place where you can say, I will offer myself up to do things. Mm-hmm. For this much money per thing, and other people come in and say, I need these kinds of things done. Mm-hmm. You don't actually interact with each other, but for example, I could ask somebody to translate GeekSpeak. So I put all the audio files of GeekSpeak up, and then some human being would say, I'll do that for $20. And then they'll pull one down and do it. And when at the output, I just get text. It looks like it's a computer doing it, uh-huh. but in reality, it's people. That's it's a service people. Amazon has.
Okay, now,
do you know where it comes from?
I am delighted, actually, about where the name for this comes from.
Awesome.
The Mechanical Turk was a famous automaton.
Well, you used a degraded term before the break.
Automata is the group of these things that are mechanical but appear to do kind of human things. A famous one is Vaucanson's duck, which appeared to eat and then also poop or lay an egg. So the Mechanical Turk appeared to be a machine with gears and such that would play and also, by the way, beat you at chess.
Yes.
And what it actually was a little tiny dude inside manipulating the...
Who was really good at chess.
Who was really good at chess.
Yes.
And, you know, it's another one of those kind of ancient showbizy things, like, why is it enough that he can escape really fast from a small space? Why does it have to pretend to be magic, you know? So the Mechanical Turk appeared to be an automaton, but in fact it was a little dude inside of a thing. So,
which is just like the Amazon service.
Yes, for what Amazon's
absolutely.
Up to there.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a great Wikipedia article about the Turk, which is what originally was called. Mm-hmm. The pictures of it, what it looks like. And it was a sensation at the time
when this thing
was qualified. It looked like a machine was playing chess and beating people.
Yeah.
And in reality, it wasn't.
It really wasn't.
I can't remember the actual guy's name, unfortunately. But
That's easily look upable. Let me do that while you... So what happened? So they fed
okay.
all this into
so they
Amazon's
fed all this
mechanical
in, and they did it out. And sure enough, what the system's doing is detecting objects. Just like us, the way we describe a scene as a beach scene or not is we know elements of objects that exist at beaches. Uh-huh. Sand maybe is an object or the type of structure of sand, for example. A bedroom's a better way to think about this.
Okay.
You can look at a room, a picture of a room, and we know pretty quickly it's a room because it's got some walls and it looks like it's indoors. We conceptualize that as a room.
Yeah.
We also think of rooms as having beds. So a room with a bed in it is most likely a bedroom. Though you could have a room with maybe 40 beds in it and now it's a showroom, right?
Right.
So an object doesn't define a space, a scene. A scene does not necessarily have objects. But for us to process whether a room has what, we actually classify objects. We do this really quickly. And so what they found is these hot nodes in this neural net were actually detecting images and objects, specifically, detecting images, obviously. They're detecting objects. And sure enough, even though they gave no concept of a bed at all to the system, nor did they tag... This is very important. Those 7 million pictures, never was a bed a tag in those pictures. But bedroom was. And if they look at all, if the neural net looked at all the images that were tagged bedrooms and made a positive match, it found that lots of times it needed this thing that was similar. And that thing became a node in the neural net that could detect. And when a human being looks at that thing, they say, that's a bed.
Right.
So the amazing thing about it was that object detection emerged naturally in the system, even though that wasn't the plan.
Whoa.
Very cool.
It's the AI thing. It's the singularity approacheth.
That's right.
By the way, the inventor of the original Mechanical Turk was Wolfgang von Kempelen.
Yeah, but who was the person that was playing chess? That's
the
question.
Was the
that was
inside?
The thing. I mean, the machine, the trickery, the magician, whatever,
yeah.
that was doing this is cool. I mean, the machine is really cool because it does remotely pick up a chess piece, right? You've got it's a puppet. It's a very complicated puppet.
Yeah.
But who was the puppeteer? Was it? And the thing is, maybe we'll never know that because, of course, the whole point of it was to keep that very secretive that there was anybody in there at all. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I can recommend a place to learn more about the Mechanical Turk and all kinds of other automata is a book called Edison's Eve, A Magical History history for the quest for mechanical life by Gabby Wood, a fantastic book. I lent it to somebody. I would like it back. If you're listening, please return it. But I will have a link to where you can get a hold of it at our website, geekspeak.org.
So this next story has probably been covered by many places by this point, but I think it's fascinating. We should talk about it a little bit on GeekSpeak, and that is that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit has released a bombshell legal ruling that basically says, hey, NSA, that mass collection of data you are doing doesn't actually fit the bill that you were quoting should do it. The Patriot Act basically doesn't cover what the NSA was doing. Which is really interesting.
That is interesting.
They haven't claimed it unconstitutional, but they very clearly said that if Congress wants to mass collect data like that, they have to explicitly say they should mass collect data.
Well, that'll be an interesting challenge for the Congress.
And the NSA did it wrong, which is really cool.
They did it wrong. All right. Well, lots more to talk about next time we see you here on GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak, by the way, is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So please reuse our stuff any way you like. Just cite your sources like a boss. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please do visit us at GeekSpeak.org and be in touch, won't you? We're at geeks@geekspeak.org on email. On Twitter, we're at KUSP Geeks. Same with Facebook, KUSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch. Thanks for listening.